For Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On this week's special On Story Valentine's Day episode, the filmmakers behind Sense and Sensibility, the Jane Austen Book Club, the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, and What Jane Saw discuss how they adapted these beloved novels for various storytelling mediums, and why they think Jane Austen's themes and stories remain so beloved and powerful today.
I mean, people were coming up to Emma on airplanes and saying, is it true that you've cut Anne Steele, the greatest character in the history? She goes, yes, I cut her.
There's a romance to these stories as they're braided into romantic comedies even today that are extremely compelling.
He's a reachable, touchable man in a wet shirt. And you're just like, okay.
Austin Film Festival's On Story will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. With six novels that produced over 60 adaptations for the screen, the talents of Jane Austen have lived on long past her time on Earth. On this episode, the filmmakers behind Sense and Sensibility, the Jane Austen Book Club, the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, as well as the academic behind the interactive website whatjanesaw.org, discuss how Jane Austen's themes and stories remain so beloved and powerful today. Producer and studio executive Lindsay Duran has worked in the movie business for more than 30 years as a studio executive and producer. Her numerous credits on film and television include The Firm, Stranger Than Fiction, and Sense and Sensibility, which earned Emma Thompson an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. Screenwriter, director, and producer Robin Swycord wrote the screenplays for such classics as Little Women, Memoirs of a Geisha, and the Jane Austen Book Club, which she also directed. Janine Barkas is a professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of Matters of Fact in Jane Austen, History, Location, and Celebrity. She's also the creator behind the digital heritage project, What Jane Saw. And most recently, she co-curated the exhibition Will and Jane, Shakespeare, Austen, and the Cult of Celebrity at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. Bernie Sue is the two-time Emmy Award-winning producer and creator behind YouTube's web series, The Lizzie Bennet Diaries, Emma Approved, and Vanity. I spoke with this distinguished panel at the 23rd Austin Film Festival in 2016.
The first big question I want to ask is, what is it about Jane Austen that is so timeless, that manages to cross age groups even now? I mean, it was so popular in the YouTube space, in addition to being something that's not just continuously read, but also now made into so many different films and television projects.
Pretty much every romantic comedy that we've seen since the dawn of cinema, I suppose, you can kind of draw a line architecturally, skeletally, plot-wise, between that romantic comedy and either Pride and Prejudice or Emma. And I think it's just incredibly amazing that this woman, 200 years ago, in the span of like 4 years, published two books, two stories that have really just kind of been reinvented over and over again. I mean, there's other works, of course, but those two are clearly her most famous works, and done over and over again for years and years and years. So there is that, I guess it's relatable is the word I would say. It's kind of hacky to say it, but that's definitely how I see our work, the work that I've done on for YouTube. The comments I get a lot are that the audience can say like, oh, I'm a Lizzie or I'm an Emma and so forth. And they kind of see themselves in those heroines.
We don't change as people of the human race, and the jealousies, the loves, the climbing for status, the desire for money and comfort. I mean, these things just continue generation after generation. And when it's set far away, in a time far away, it becomes mythical in a way. That's why we love fairy tales. In this other time, they lived just like us. So we're willing to look at ourselves in this other time wearing different clothing in a way that maybe we don't. We aren't quite ready to look at ourselves in contemporary life. She has such a great way of using the boundaries, the social boundaries of the time, to create conflict and situation for these people so that they have no other way. They must get married in order to survive, or they become like the pathetic spinsters that she constantly portrays. And so the stakes are super high for the women that are in the books. And she just has a way of restating that problem over and over again in these books. So in a way, it's a sort of a, you know, it's contemporary because it feels feminist, even though in a lot of ways her values were very conservative, I feel, when you read the books. Certainly, you know, it was very easy to lose her favor by small social missteps. But generally speaking, she has a bead on the situation of what happens when you put people in a box.
I ask this question all the time of my students. So I teach at UT. And thanks to my colleagues up here, who I think have helped to make Jane Austen even more popular at this sort of 200 mark that we're living in now, I always ask my classroom, like, why are you here? And in fact, today, like, why are you here? Jane Austen, 200, not exactly new. And we can't supersaturate the demand on campus for a woman who writes about a world, and mostly it's women in my classrooms, and it's mostly women here today. And it's a world where women can't hold jobs, can't inherit money or land, and have to sit around waiting for Mr. Darcy. Don't sign me up for that. And yet there's a romance to these stories as they're braided into romantic comedies even today that are extremely compelling, that my students articulate as the opposite of their worlds. They're busy, social media filled, lots of choices, lots of options, so many choices, what do I choose? That there seems to be a strange backlash of desire for a world that is quiet, and where you have to sit around waiting for your boyfriend to write you 8 years later. And I didn't expect that. I didn't expect my students to articulate the desire for quiet in a world where we're constantly trying to, even in the classroom, entertain them and compete with other options that they have on their time.
One of the things that drew me to Sense and Sensibility was that I felt that there was a question in it that's still very contemporary, which is, who are we supposed to marry? Are we supposed to marry our best friend? Are we supposed to marry the person who makes us feel this incredible fire, even though they might not be as steady as this best friend person? And I think that's a universal question. I think it's a contemporary question. I think it's probably always been a question. And to me, the two sisters, you know, one is essentially does marry her best friend, and the other one learns that, you know, the man that she feels this incredible passion for has chosen money over her. And I always loved the idea that people at the end of the movie could argue and say, has she matured enough to marry Colonel Brandon, or has she settled for Colonel Brandon? And I think that's a kind of unanswerable question, and it's easy to take both sides, and I think that that's a very contemporary situation still. And unfortunately, I think the idea of marrying for money is still on the table. It hasn't been that long since I knew a young woman who, she was single with a child, and she had two guys who were in love with her, and they both wanted to marry her, and one had a lot of money, and one had no money, and it was a real question for her. I mean, she loved the poor guy more than she loved the rich guy, but she knew she was on welfare, and she knew that with one guy she could have a house, and that her daughter would be okay, and with the other guy it was just going to be love, and they didn't really know. So again, it hasn't been that long since I knew somebody who was in that situation. So both of those situations, I think, are still real. And I think what Robin said is particularly important, which is that the stakes are high. It's hard to do a love story now where the stakes are as high. That this notion that of being a spinster and what that meant, or becoming a governess, which might sound kind of romantic and cool in Jane Eyre, but actually it's horrible, 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 at that point in time, kind of an enslavement in a way, that the stakes were enormous. And it's so hard now to write a romantic comedy in the age of swipe right, swipe left, where I don't know how many of you read Aziz Ansari's book about modern romance and dating, and it's so clear about this notion that everybody thinks that maybe the next time you swipe, it'll be the one. And so how can you ever be with this one, really, when they're right there on your phone? You could do that, and there might be somebody else. So the smallness of it, the stakes of it, the quiet of it, I think is a really good point. I think all really resonates now. Plus, it's genius writing. I mean, it's just really good writing, and really good writing survives.
Forever and ever, since she's written, writers have read her work with awe. I think it was Kipling who was asked if he read novels much, and he said, yes, I read all six of them every year. So, you know, she exists kind of really as a paragon of that kind of succinct, accurate clarity, and could really turn a phrase in an amusing way. So her books are so entertaining to read. So that clarity of reading and knowing, reading and recognizing, is tremendously rewarding for people. And we get the same thing when we go to the movies, actually. People do things that are human and instantly recognizable in the first five pages of your screenplay. You're on board. And when I teach writing, I call that alignment. That you align with that character, whether you like them or not. People don't like Wakefield, but they align with him. And she's just extraordinarily good at making you feel for and be with her characters from the get-go. So it just makes the drama part of it so easy.
I study and write about Jane Austen and her interests in her contemporary culture, in her celebrity culture. In her writing, what I find so surprising is that on the one hand, and you've already used the word timeless, we still connect with her stories. And at the same time, she's super saturated with the particulars of her specific world 200 years ago. But also that specificity that is both continuous, celebrity culture then. She's a name dropper. Fitzwilliam, Darcy, Dashwood, those are all hugely important contemporary names in the newspapers at the time. And she's playing with fire. And yet she's creating something that 200 years ago, when the fame of those names have faded and been replaced by the fame of her own characters, continue to speak to us in terms of the kinds of characters that she's created. So she's somebody who seems to be adapting pop culture and making the new one for the next generation. And I find that unique and remarkable.
Well, Bernie, I think you actually kind of really touched on that in a big way in yours. I mean, I think you really feel what you're talking about when you watch Lizzie Bennet Diaries. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to say it was easy. It was just all there, though. It's like the work is there. It's very clear. The architecture, the skeletal structure of the narrative, the great characters that she designed. Yeah, you do some dialing to modernize them, of course, with things like the ability to swipe left and right, which we didn't even have when Lizzie Bennet Diaries came out. But otherwise, it was relatively a simple, straightforward adaptation.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. My mom gave each of us one of these last Christmas. I have yet to wear it. Ever. Who am I? I'm a 24-year-old grad student with a mountain of student loans, living at home and preparing for a career. But to my mom, the only thing that matters is that I'm single. My name is Lizzie Bennet, and this is my life.
We're very accurate. We cover pretty much every single nuance of all the characters, and we find ways to modernize each of the thematics of each of these hard choices. How Charlotte decides to marry Collins, what is that today? Lydia's scandal, what is that today? Even things like that are able to be drawn from, as you said, two centuries later.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We're deconstructing Jane Austen on this special Valentine's Day episode of On Story with Sense and Sensibility producer Lindsay Duran, the Jane Austen Book Club screenwriter Robin Swycord, Jane Austen historian Janine Barkas, and Lizzie Bennet Diaries creator Bernie Sue. Now, back to our panel.
I was thinking about a while ago, maybe even 20 years ago, my husband and I were in that situation. We were making our wills, and you have to decide where do you want your money to go if you both die in the same car crash. And I said, well, you know, in my case, I would leave it to my brother, and then if my mother's still alive, obviously he'll take care of my mother. And I went, oh my God, this is the first chapter of Sense and Sensibility.
John, you will find out soon enough from my will that the estate of Norland was left to me in such a way as prevents me from dividing it between my two families.
Calm yourself, Father. This cannot be good for you.
Norland, in its entirety, is therefore yours by law, and I am happy for you and Fanny. But your stepmother, my wife and daughters, are left only £500 a year, barely enough to live on, nothing for the girls' dowries. You must help them.
Well, of course.
You must promise to do this.
This is the same thing, you know, and there's a sister-in-law.
Help them? What do you mean, help them?
Dearest, I mean to give them £3,000. The interest will provide them with a little extra income.
You know, I suddenly went, this is exactly that. You think, oh, of course they're going to behave well, and by the time they're done, they've figured out that giving her a fowl at Christmas every year is enough.
£1,500, then. What do you say to £1,500?
What brother on earth would do half so much for his rail sisters?
You know, you start at £3,000, and you dumb it down, you begin to justify.
Although, to say the truth, I'm convinced within myself that your father had no idea of your giving them money.
They will have £500 a year amongst them as it is.
And what on earth could four women want for more than that? Their housekeeping will be nothing at all. They'll have no carriage, no horses, hardly any servants, and will keep no company. Only conceive how comfortable they will be. They will be much more able to give you something.
It was just such a clear thing of all these years later of here we are, that character, that Fanny character who figures out how to justify giving somebody nothing when clearly the intent was to make them comfortable for the rest of their lives is one of those things that you still think about. I adore my brother. I knew he wasn't going to do anything wrong, but she articulates so beautifully how that could happen. So I feel like we do see those people all around us. We recognize them instantly. We're always talking about, you know, there's this person and there's this person and those incredible passive-aggressive characters that are there that are so beautiful and funny. I just see them all around me all the time.
Yeah, well, she's almost a study in psychology in each of her books. But the factor of morality I find really interesting in that all of her work has a core about morality and how we should live our lives and lessons from characters who take the wrong path. And interestingly, we're living in a culture right now where the news is full of people who don't seem to ever question their morality. Like, but how it is that, if it's interesting to me that in the world we live in where I feel like that's our current culture, what makes people so drawn to stories that are so parochial in their morality?
I just remember that Robin and I were on a panel a long time ago with Amy Heckerling talking for the Jane Austen Society. And somebody said, what's the hardest thing about adapting Jane Austen? And Amy said, the whole honor thing. Which I've never forgotten.
You've got a great memory, Lindsay. My God, I'm in awe of you.
Well, I've never forgotten that, the whole honor thing. I just thought it was so funny. But but it is true. One of the things that you have to deal with are people who keep their word. I mean, in Sense and Sensibility, a horrible person shares a secret with Eleanor just designed to hurt her, and she doesn't, and she says, promise me you'll never tell anybody. So she makes a promise to a terrible person and keeps it. She doesn't tell her sister, she doesn't tell her mother, she gets in terrible trouble and is very hurt because she doesn't share it, but she doesn't share it. So how do you, as a writer, how do you, as a performer, build a world in which that kind of honor matters and you still respect and understand a character who behaves that way? And I think when you talk about students who long for quiet, I think people long for honor. And I think when they see it, if you can get it right on screen and make it understandable, it's a very attractive and these days maybe mysterious thing.
Yeah.
So before I taught Jane Austen, I taught Samuel Richardson. Anybody heard of Samuel Richardson? Okay, well, at least somebody's good. Because he's got no action figure and no movie. So,
Yet.
Good. He is considered one of the great moralist writers of the 18th century and was one of Jane Austen's supposedly famous favorite writers. She set Sir Charles Grandison, his very moral, very long book about a moral man, into a play. So it's the only play we have in her hand that's at Chawton House Library in England. And it's in the Will and Jane show in DC right now. There was nothing that was made romantic and attractive to students about, I mean, I really had to sell Samuel Richardson. And thanks to these lovely people, I don't have to work as hard on selling Jane Austen. But there is, if you're a teacher and you're choosing books that you want your students to both relate to as well as emulate, there's, you know, as Nabokov says, you could do worse than Jane Austen. That was sort of a backhanded compliment on his side. That's as good as he ever got. But he put her on the syllabus, and I'm putting her on my syllabus. And at the moment, I could teach Jane Austen 24/7 and not supersaturate that demand. And that means that the audience you're describing is hungry for that kind of moral structure as well as maybe the quiet.
I'll give a story related to the question about like the morality of the character or the so when Lizzie Bennet Diaries and Emma Approve are both running, now you think about the experience. We now have the movies, the books, and we can just pick the book up and, you know, set aside whatever how long it takes you, right? Read the book and read the book and begin and end. When Lizzie Bennet Diaries and Emma were running, they only ran 2 episodes a week, and we were only running maybe 15 minutes of content per week. Like, we never did more than that weekly. So we were basically releasing those stories a chapter at a time, pretty much, in the context of the chapterized novels. So think about this from one, those of you who've read, ideally, I think most of you probably have, those two books, and you're only getting it that little bit at a time. You have to be there or watch it or wait for it to all come out or follow along with the audience and have that experience, okay? So think about that and go through the arc of Lizzie or Emma, the two characters, and how much they're hated, or they go through these things where it's controversial, or like, are they the right, are they in the wrong type thing? Are they being silly or whatever? I'm trying to mince my words a bit. So I'm not trying to say say the things that our commenters would say. For example, they would, especially during the Collins arc or the Wickham arc of our story, there were some pretty harsh comments for our version of Lizzie. Like they didn't like her. They didn't like what we were doing to her. And I would have to defend it. Well, I don't think I had to, but I was defending it, saying that this is where she is right now. Like, she hasn't even got to Darcy yet. Let's get through this, people. Like, this, we're doing a really slow burn here. And this is, if you think about, I'm trying to think when those were like 8 weeks, no, more than that, 16 weeks, 20 weeks into the story. So they've been following the story for 20 weeks, and we still haven't gotten to the Darcy proposal yet. And that's what the audience was all waiting for, of course, right? So you have that experience. Now, think of it from a different perspective. Imagine, which is a lot of our audience, hadn't read either book, hadn't watched any of the movies. I mean, there were people who jumped in our show who were not Jane Austen fans, rightfully. There are people out there who are not Jane Austen fans, and that's fine. But we were able to convert them because, whatever reason, they liked our show, it was more accessible to them, whatever reason. And they were able to follow along as someone who hadn't read the book or knew what was going on. They knew, of course, the basic stuff, like, oh, this is Guy Darcy, he's going to come, and that's, they know how it's supposed to end about them getting together. But they didn't know all the details, like the level of us here and probably most of us in this room do. So imagine that experience now. You're getting it a chapter a week, and you're just getting the slow burn of journey through this character. And this character also is like almost literally talking to you, going through experience. And so you have that. So what you'd find, I'm guessing, I'm not trying to totally speak for the audience, but what I'm theorizing is that the audience got to see this arc happen in real time, and thus relate to those two heroines and their growth of their rise of pride and falls and egos and all those things and all the lessons they learned and all the flaws they go through. So, for example, Ashley Clements, who plays Lizzie Bennet in our show, huge Austen fan, has read all the books, could sit up here and probably speak more to her than I could, of the author. And she said that her favorite part of doing the show was that Lizzie was so flawed as a person. And which is kind of funny in the sense that whenever you ask them, like, oh, what's so special about Lizzie Bennet? Lizzie Bennet, the character, it's like, oh, she's so independent. They say, they list all these qualities, high qualities that we all want to emulate as men and women. And yet, her biggest comment and what she loved about the character was that she was flawed and she was growing with her through this journey of a year. So I found that to be really interesting.
So we talk about her great characters, but Janine, can you tell us a little bit more about her? I mean, what was she really like? Was she like Lizzie Bennet? Who was she like?
No one here would want to invite Jane Austen to a dinner party, I think. Because on the ride home with Cassandra, she would be deconstructing that dinner party in a way that would just be cruel. Yeah.
So it's Nora Ephron then.
Very much, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. There's something sharp and cruel about her wit. We have access to only a small number of her letters, thanks to her sister, Cassandra, who, for whatever reason that we assume were good, burnt a stash of letters that we believe were hundreds of letters. So for someone who, in that domestic environment, wrote an enormous amount, went away from her sister, and wrote an enormous amount to relatives, that would have yielded more of those juicy...
unkind.
That juicy unkindness. I think it's because we think of Austen sometimes in line with the Bronte sisters, and that is just so wrong. That she died in 1817, and the Bronte sisters don't really write and rise to their own kind of fame until 40 years after that. And they come to of age in the Victorian era, and Austen is not a proto-Victorian novelist. The problem was her sister... her life lasted well into the Victorian era, and she must have adopted different mores and different standards about what was suitable to say in a letter. And by that time, Jane Austen was rising into popularity, especially Americans were apparently writing Cassandra for snippets of signatures and pieces of her handwriting. And she cut those things up and sent them to the fans, but also sliced and diced the remaining letters and then burnt the rest. Probably because they both grew up in an age in which, at the end of the 18th century, a lot of things could be said. It was the age of snark.
Dangerous liaisons.
Yeah, dangerous liaisons. Samuel Richardson wrote a novel that Dangerous Liaisons is modeled after. I mean, sort of all of a piece. And the Victorian era, as we know, kind of drew the strings of the corsets tighter. That was a different era. And so in terms of her life, I think that we often forget to dial the clock back enough.
Uh-huh. So you're what Jane saw, I think, is something interesting to just give people a little brief where you can go online and see it. But it's fascinating what you were telling us about having gotten specifications to give to the people to see this virtual reality piece on the computer of what the world she actually lived in when she was writing her stories.
WhatJaneSaw.org is a website. It's a 2D reconstruction, but it incorporates the kind of the camera lens, because that's what we are. It's part of our modern psyche. And so I wish Jane Austen had, when she attended these two museums, the first Shakespeare Museum, and we've picked the 1796 as the date that puts her closest around the corner. So the first art gallery that turned out to be dedicated to William Shakespeare, and also reconstruction of the first one-man show in the world of art history dedicated to Sir Joshua Reynolds, the great portraitist, and the great portraitist of famous people in the 18th century. So the celebrity painter of that particular era. She went to attend those two shows, and I became interested in her exposure to celebrity culture, or exposure to Shakespeare, and wanted to reconstruct. And as an academic, once you scratch, you know, one area, you got to do the whole thing. So we started reconstructing the whole show as she saw it, hanging virtual paintings on virtual walls in the manner in which she must have seen these famous people in the Sir Joshua Reynolds exhibition, as well as the life-size paintings that offered the binge-watching equivalent of seeing all of Shakespeare in one go. And then the Texas Advanced Computing Center approached me and they said, you know, we would really like to do a 3D version of that project. And I said, why? And they said, well, because we have the technology. I said, yeah, but why? I mean, what am I going to learn from that by doing it with a different toy? I'm just not toy oriented.
Such a female reaction.
I know. It wasn't. It was a bunch of guys with great Brazilian accents, and I can't really do that. But we want to connect the laser beams. And it's like, no, we can float. We can float the avatars. And it's like, no. Gravity still worked in 1813. Can't do that. So there are a lot of toys that they have. But then they asked me a question, which just threw me. They said, well, let us do it. And I said, sure. Okay, great. What was Jane Austen's height? I said, well, why do you need to know that? I suppose I could find out. And they said, well, because we can set the eye height of the Oculus Rift goggles, the viewing height at her height. So she was 5'7", 5'8", according to a garment. She was quite tall. Two of her brothers were around 6 feet. So there was a tall family. But there's a pelisse, a certain kind of garment, an outer garment that still remains in a museum in Hampshire. And from that, we can determine what her height was. And then they also asked me, okay, the building, 52 Pall Mall, where both museums took place that we reconstructed, what was its alignment to the street? And I said, well, why do you want to know that? And they said, well, if you could tell us what time of day she attended the Reynolds exhibition, we can put the sun in the sky in just the way, and light the inside in just the way that it was at, you know, if I know the orientation of the building. And that was so exciting. And so, yeah, talk about what Jane saw, to really be in her footsteps and see that, not just see it as a postage size painting, postage stamp size painting on a computer, flat computer screen, but to actually put those goggles on and then walk in her footsteps. And my students are amazed when we get to do that. So the 3D part is not yet downloadable, portable. It's only available on the Oculus Rift and inside the Viz Lab, the visualization lab, so the holodeck. So I take my students to the holodeck. We did this last week, and their reaction is one of this sense of visceral authenticity, that wanting to feel, to be in that world, that the movies help us over the threshold of her imagined world in one way, but VR may be the next thing.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television. Ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back deconstructing Jane Austen on this special Valentine's Day episode of On Story with Sense and Sensibility producer Lindsay Duran, the Jane Austen Book Club screenwriter Robin Swycord, Jane Austen historian Janine Barkus, and Lizzie Bennett Diaries creator Bernie Sue. For more on Jane Austen, visit whatjanesaw.org, which offers an immersive look and continuing examination of the influence of the paintings of Sir Joshua Reynolds on the writing of Jane Austen. Now, back to our panel.
Two of Austen's novels, her first two novels, first two published novels, Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility, we know were written initially drafted as epistolary novels, novels in the form of epistles, as exchanged between characters with letters. So they were conceived initially and shared among the family entirely in letter form. So you can kind of imagine in Sense and Sensibility, where Marianne is constantly writing Willoughby, that really the first draft of that would have been reading Willoughby's letters and then Marianne's, and then Willoughby's and then Marianne's, and then Willoughby's and then Marianne's. And by the time Austen becomes an adult and we turn over into the early 19th century, and she's now 25. She was born in 1775, so in 1800, she turns 25. This is a throwback. This is no longer the way people are starting to write three-volume novels. And the three-volume novel takes over. It's more omnisciently narrated. And then Austen kind of creates her own tweak on that, what we call free and direct discourse, right? Where you're reading the novel, and it, even the very first line of Pride and Prejudice, it's a truth universally acknowledged that a young man of good fortune must be a wonderful wife. That line, that's not an omnisciently narrated truth. That's not universal truth. That is Mrs. Bennett's version of the world's universal truth. And that's an example of free and direct discourse, where Austen has somehow mashed this immediacy of the letter writing, where you see the character, their voice, they own it, and this omnisciently narrated story. And she bleeds in between, occasionally borrowing, when Marianne meets Willoughby on that hill in the storm. I mean, seriously, how cinematic can you possibly get? You know, there's a storm, there's a guy with a couple of guns and some dogs, and he walks in, and a horse.
The white horse.
You made it a horse. That's Marianne. That's her language, her fantasy, and that's what we call free and direct discourse. So there is a way in which we still have some of that immediacy bleeding into the omniscient point of view. But she herself took it out of her first draft. So we only have Lady Susan left, which now has been turned into the wonderful film Love and Friendship. That's the only thing we have left of how she initially started writing in that epistolary mode.
When Emma Thompson was adapting Sense and Sensibility, we felt very free to change the dialogue. I didn't realize what a thorny thing that was at the time, that the BBC had always been very, very slavish. And we were making up scenes, and we added a whole first act that isn't in the book. And I felt very free to do that. Maybe because I'm an American, I didn't realize that was not something you could do. And Emma felt very free to do that as well. So there was a moment when we were shooting the ball scene where Marianne sees Willoughby and realizes that he's with somebody else. And she says, "My goodness, Willoughby, will you not shake hands with me?" And we had an expert around for lots of things about how low the bows would be and how low the curtsies would be and how a woman would sit then before there was rock and roll and before the pelvis was freed by rock and roll. It was so wonderful, all this stuff. And she said, we had had to choose a year for the movie because, you know, she wrote it initially one way and then it was published over here, and where did we want to set it? And I think we finally said 1800. And the expert said they wouldn't have been shaking hands yet. Oh. And Emma said, "It's in the book." It's like one of three lines that's actually from the book. Can we please keep it because it's actually in the book? But what we realized was that the year that we'd chosen was not actually a year in which people were shaking hands yet. And so there was all of this kind of detail about that kind of stuff, which was so interesting. But we felt if you go and look at the book and you look at the adaptation, you see that there is a memory of it, mm-hmm. rather than the thing itself. And I thought that was the amazing thing about Emma as a screenwriter, was that she could capture the voice of that time and the voice of that language without being slavish to the actual words, so you don't feel betrayed. And it was so interesting to us that there was always this sense that the Jane Austen Society was going to hate this movie. I mean, people were coming up to Emma on airplanes and saying, is it true that you've cut Anne Steele, the greatest character in the history? She goes, yes, I cut her. There was just this sense, and then they were too old for the part, even though they were, you know, why can't it be like the, you know, the Olivier one, and then it was like the Olivier was older, and there was just this sense that we were going to be hated by the very people that we thought would love us the most. And then it all turned around, everybody loved it. But people would say to Emma, you know, my favorite scene in the movie was my favorite scene in the book, where Marianne goes to the top of the hillside and looks down at Willoughby's house and recites the book. It's not in the book. It's on the book, and these were members of the Jane Austen Society, so it all began to merge, and I thought that was such a great compliment to her as a storytelling, that she could do it in such a way that you felt the authenticity of it, even when it wasn't authentic at all.
I think Emma Thompson walks on water. And one of the things that you didn't mention is what she cuts out.
Yeah.
So there's an entire scene in the novel where Willoughby comes while Marianne is, of course, on her third day of in her deathbed, you know, sort of, and he begins in his forked-tongued, rakish way to describe to Eleanor his true motivations. And it's a really long scene.
Yeah.
It's the only scene where Jane Austen swears because Willoughby is drunk. It's an amazing scene.
Yeah, it's why I wanted to adapt the book.
And it totally works to cut it.
Uh-huh.
You just don't need it. And instead, you have that wonderful shot of the back of a horse that he's sitting on as he's watching her get married. That's it. You see regret at a glance.
It was really interesting because it really was. And I don't know if you have had this experience, Robin, but so often, and I hear this from actors, I hear it from directors, I hear it from writers, the reason that you wanted to do something gets cut. Always. It's like if there's a line of dialogue that made an actor do the movie, it's never in the movie. It's weird how that works. And that scene is so incredible because she thinks it's her mother arriving. And Marianne is finally okay, and she runs down the stairs. At least maybe I'm remembering script scenes that aren't actually in the book, but that's how it was, because the scene was written. She runs down thinking it's her mother, and it's when, and in walked Willoughby, right? Isn't that the line? It's just one of the great, great moments. And then there's this whole scene, and Emma wrote the scene, and it didn't work. It was not a moment where you wanted to stop the movie. It just didn't work. And we needed the information, which we kind of gave to Brandon, and we kind of put it all over the place. But I loved that scene, and I always wanted to make it work. And then when Ang Lee became involved and he read the book for the first time, he said, well, what about this scene? This is one of the greatest scenes ever. We've got to put it back. And I was like, yeah, we're going to put it back. And we tried to put it back, and we had a scene in Amy Pascal's office at Sony where it was decided that we just couldn't have it, and I wept. I really did. I cried. I couldn't believe we were never going to get to have it, but we couldn't have it. And really what we did was replace it with that little two-line scene of Marianne and Eleanor on the bed. It's like, well, he did love you, but not enough.
I think that one of the horrible things about being a filmmaker and also being a tremendous reader is that you think that everything in the novel is wonderful. You just attach to everything. Whether you may have your favorite scenes, but all of it feels kind of sacred. Then as you start dismantling it in the writing stage, you start making these kind of selections of, we don't need that character, this thematically doesn't fit with what we're focusing on, you know, because you're kind of boiling stuff down to a spine. Then you go through the editing process, as I just did fairly recently with my film Wakefield, which is an adaptation of an E.L. Doctorow short story. And you end up the tyranny of pace. And this is something that novelists don't have to think quite so much about. You know, we've all read slow-paced novels, and you can put it down and take a rest and pick it back up and so forth. It's different from a movie. With a movie, you're making a promise to the audience, which is, I'm going to hold your hand, and I'm going to take you at a certain speed through this story, and you're going to have a very full experience, and we're not going to let the pace lag.
Since you mentioned, I just wanted to mention receiving Emma Thompson's typescript of Sense and Sensibility for the Will and Jane exhibition that's currently in D.C., which is now lying next, every time I think of it, it gives me chills. It's lying next to Jane Austen's adaptation of a contemporary novel for the family stage. So Sir Charles Grandison, written in Jane Austen's hand, is now lying next to Emma Thompson's typescript. As somebody who studies texts and things of text from edition to edition, yes, but not as these flexible, living things that that movie scripts must be, even during the making of it.
Yeah, it was a four-year process. I mean, it went on. There was a whole version that started at Barton where we had no Norland at all. I was like, no, that didn't work. Put it, but it just goes on. And even on the set, you know, you're making changes. There was a line in the script that I was just thinking about, really, because it was Marianne's, when the little Atlas scene that Emma totally created. And Margaret comes out from under the piano and says, you know, the mouth of the Nile is in Egypt or something. And somebody said, the source of the Nile is in Egypt. And somebody in the crew went, you know, the source of the Nile is not in Egypt. And we were thinking about the mouth and not the source. And then it was like, well, what was the country then? And somebody, because it was Ethiopia, but what was Ethiopia then? And it was Abyssinia. And so it was changed right there, as one would. And I was just watching The Boy Next Door, which is a Jennifer Lopez movie that came out last year, or maybe earlier. I don't know how many of you have seen it, but there's an amazing scene because The Boy Next Door is this guy who's trying to seduce her, and she teaches classics at the local high school, and he seems to know the Odyssey by heart. So he brings her, as the beginning of his seduction, he brings her what looks like a kind of Victorian book. And he said, dear, this is for you. And she says, I can't keep this. It's a first edition of the Iliad. And he says, don't worry, I picked it up at a yard sale for a dollar. I thought, how many versions of the script did that go through, plus shooting it, plus editing it, where nobody went, a first edition of the Iliad?
That was not even in the theater a day before that clip was up on the internet.
Oh, is that true? I didn't even know that.
As a can't believe this even.
I mean, it was stunned.
They were ravaged for that scene.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
As they deserved to be, right? Okay, so the other thing that you left out, which was in that Folger Library in a glass case, is Darcy Colin Firth's shirt, right?
So in the 18th century, David Garrick, the Colin Firth of his day, played Richard III and became the most famous iconic actor of Shakespeare. And we're in our exhibition, we're putting that example where there's Richard III, with sword, all that repetition in figurines, Staffordshire flat backs, things you have to dust, and celebrity pinups and paintings next to, well, what is the moment in Jane Austen studies or Jane Austen worship, the cult of Jane, that is the iconic image that's repeated over and over and over again. And we had to switch mediums. We suddenly realized that it was the digital medium that we were looking for in terms of that repetition. And yeah, it's this scene that Jane Austen never wrote, where Colin Firth is coming out of that pond in every GIF on Facebook. That is that repeated moment. And the shirt itself has become this celebrity item where we thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun to get the shirt? And then the New York Times wrote about the shirt is coming to America. And I mean, I'm just a mere academic. Things like this don't happen to me. And then the New Yorker did a spoof where they wrote the celebrity writer, you know, the writer on the contract that the shirt should be sprayed with Derbyshire pond water every 10 minutes or whatever. And so before the show was even up, the celebrity of this single item had kind of taken over, and people were coming to the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., asking to see the shirt, not the first folio, but the shirt. And they're saying, I'm sorry, ma'am, but that show isn't up until later in August. So there is something about that moment that took us all by surprise. And then you kind of inhabit that celebrity. So yeah, I've bent my knee in front of the shirt in the gallery because that's part of the fun. That's part of the kind of cheeky enjoyment of Jane Austen's own celebrity. And we're different, I think. The Jane Austen Society you spoke about earlier is different. They call themselves the Janeites. Shakespeare scholars don't call themselves the Willies. There's
a reason for that.
True enough. But I just think that there's a certain kind of self-awareness that Jane Austen fans have about their own fandom that's part of the fun.
You know, Andrew Davies wrote that adaptation. It was about 6 hours, I believe. And so that scene takes place, and if had been one long movie, that would have been an Act Three moment. And that if he had appeared in a wet shirt in Act One, it would not have had that impact. If he had appeared in a wet shirt in Act Two, it would have not had that impact. But it happened at a moment when this Andrew Davies had perfectly set up that they were so close and yet so far. She was going to be traveling in this mythical land where his ancestral home was. There was the chance that she could run into him. They're going to tour that house. She has mixed feelings about it. Kind of think I shouldn't go. What if I run into him? No, he's away. He's away. You're never going to run into him. So the subject is up, whether or not they're going to meet. And you have this beautiful Act Three collision. At the very moment that you were just most dreading and hoping, which is what Aristotle always talked about as the state you want to be in before catharsis, dreading and hoping that they would run into each other, here he is and he emerges, and it's the full sexuality. It's not like the gentleman. He's a reachable, touchable man in a wet shirt. And you're just like, okay, okay. And that's the power. It came out of writing, and it was beautifully directed and beautifully brought out by his performance and his willingness to don the wet shirt. But I can tell you, it would not have had that power had it been placed anywhere else.
Okay, now I have to add that in Jane Austen's novel, it is an Act Three moment. And it's not the man in the shirt. No, it's the building that is suddenly in view. So Jane Austen wrote 3-volume novels, and Pride and Prejudice is 3 volumes. And you could check it out of the library 1 volume at a time, but it's published as a unit. And the first chapter of volume 3 is where Elizabeth Bennet is riding with the gardeners up the carriage, and you start low, and you go up and up and up, and then she sees Pemberley. And it warrants an exclamation point, which Jane Austen doesn't use very often, about how of this I might have been mistress. And it's a moment of ecstasy, and it's a moment of total awe, and it's a sexy moment. It just isn't wearing a wet shirt. And I think that Andrew Davis, as a super genius that he is, turned it into something that where the metaphor became literal. That the building, which is always representing, you know, if the windows are well hung, well then, you know, the building is always representing the virility of its owner, and he just simply put a shirt on it.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.